Spatulum. We know the old story all too well. The school bully relentlessly torments anyone who is perceived to be acting gay. Years later, we find out that that gentleman himself is gay. The politician who accuses each of her opponents of falsely beefing up their record, only to find out that she herself has beefed up that record. Or the parent who chides their child for not trying hard enough at sports, when they themselves always felt second best in the field. Too often, the faults we find in others are simply a reflection of the faults we are trying to hide in ourselves. The psychological term for this is projection. And while the term is relatively new, this kind of behavior has been going on since the beginning of time. Even our Talmudic rabbis knew that we were prone to blame others for faults that we were afraid of in ourselves. In the Talmud, we read a story about Rabbi Abaye. He once overheard a man ask a woman if he could accompany her as they walked through the forest. Suspecting that the man planned to seduce her, Rabbi Abaye followed them. But when no foul play occurred and the couple reached the other side of the forest, they went their separate ways. It's not the evil inclination. It is not their evil inclination, but my own that was whispering in my ear, said Abaye. Had I been with that woman, I surely would have seduced her. Here the rabbi is recognizing his own actions, but more often than not, we don't recognize what we are doing. When we project onto others the faults that we ourselves are harboring, it can lead to devastating results. This week we read about one of the most disturbing rituals in the Torah. We read, Adonai said to Moses, speak to the Israelite people and say to them, if any man's wife has gone astray and broken faith with him in that another man has had carnal relations with her unbeknownst to her husband, and she keeps secret the fact that she has defiled herself without being forced, and there is no witness against her, but in a fit of jealousy, he is wrought up about his wife who has defiled herself. Or, if in a fit of jealousy comes over him, he is wrought up about his wife, although she has not defiled herself. It then goes on to describe a humiliating ritual in which the woman is subjected in order to prove whether or not she has been unfaithful. She is brought before the priest, her hair is uncovered, some say her chest as well, and she is made to drink a mixture of water, dirt from the temple floor, and the mushed up remains of a curse written on parchment. The curse, which the priest recites before writing it on parchment and dissolving it, says, if no other party has lain with you, if you have not gone astray in defilement while living in your husband's household, be immune to the harm from this water of bitterness that induces the spell. But if you have gone astray while living in your husband's household, if you have defiled yourself, if any party other than your husband has had carnal relations with you, may Adonai make you a curse and a malediction among your people. As Adonai causes your thigh to sag and your belly to distend, may this water induce the spell enter your body, causing your belly to distend and your thigh to sag. And the woman is supposed to say, Amen ve Amen. After the curse is read and written and dissolved into the water, the woman is made to drink this gross mixture. If she experiences the prescribed reaction, she is declared a curse among her people. If nothing happens, she is declared pure and allowed to return home with her husband. And some say she will soon become pregnant. Wait, what? She's allowed to return home to the man that had just publicly accused her of cheating and put her through a humiliating trial to assuage his own assumptions. Maybe I'm less forgiving, but I'm not sure going home with him and having relations would be on my to-do list in the immediate aftermath. But more disturbing than the ritual itself, or the fact that if she is found innocent, she's supposed to carry on as if nothing has happened, is the fact that the man can bring this upon his wife for no more than a suspicion of infidelity. As it reads, a fit of jealousy comes over him, and he is wrought up about his wife who defiled herself, or a fit of jealousy comes over him, and he is wrought up about his wife, although she has not defiled herself. In other words, even if the wife has done nothing to raise suspicion, the husband can simply suspect that something is amiss and subject his wife to this. Even the rabbi saw this as an immediate problem and created several limits to the practice before ultimately outlawing it altogether. These limits included that the husband has to have warned his wife about being alone with the gentleman. There needs to be witnesses that she was alone with him, which, by the way, itself is problematic. If there were witnesses, she wasn't alone. The court also had to try and dissuade her from partaking in the ritual by reminding her she could just leave the marriage and forego the ketubah, the amount that she was due, if he had divorced her otherwise. And warning her that if she dies from this ritual, so does the gentleman that she had a relation with. But the most relevant comment that the rabbis wrote is that this ritual will only work if the husband himself has never engaged in forbidden relations. This ritual will only work if the husband himself is blameless. In other words, the husband couldn't use this ritual as a way to hide his own shame at having cheated on his wife. Even if the husband did not recognize his actions as projecting onto his wife what he himself had done, if in his heart he knew that he had been cheated, then this ritual would be rendered futile, as it would have no effect whether the woman had committed any sin or not. By making sure that the husband knew that this ritual could not be used as a way to hide his own shame, many unnecessary rituals were avoided. And eventually the rabbis realized that too many people had engaged in this kind of action and put an end to the practice altogether. But why is it that we so often accuse others of doing exactly what we ourselves do? While all of us have engaged in this practice at times, one who engages excessively in projection is often labeled a narcissist. But according to the psychologist, this behavior can artificially and temporarily reduce the anxiety and the discomfort about ourselves by projecting onto others what we are not yet ready to admit about ourselves. But as many of us may have experienced, this rarely ends well. Like Rabbi Abaya, we need to bring our actions into our conscience. Am I projecting? Is my criticism of my loved ones stemming from something I myself am anxious about? There is a saying that when you point your finger at somebody, you are simultaneously pointing three fingers at yourself. We have all accused or faulted others for that which we ourselves are guilty of. How have we projected our biggest fears about our own life onto those who we love? But more importantly, how do we begin to recognize and alter this behavior? The first step is taking time and effort to identify when we are engaging in this behavior. One sign of projection is filling in unknown information with assumptions from our own lived experience. Like Rabbi Abaya, he didn't know the motives of the man, so he assumed, incorrectly, that man would do the same that he himself would have done. If we can recognize that we are placing our own assumptions on others, we can begin to recognize when we may be misplacing blame. Another sign of projection is when we make a lot of "you" statements directed at others of whom we don't really know. Once we've identified that we are projecting our fears and our insecurities onto others, we can work on approaching life from a standpoint of curiosity rather than accusation. And like other faults we attempt to correct, by being aware of when we fall into old patterns, we can learn to avoid them. With sustained awareness and effort, we can learn to address our insecurities and faults in far more productive ways. Shabbat Shalom.